tonight on Arena. Four brand new films are up for review. Cortia Reardon talks about greatest basslines, and Emily LaBarge discusses her new book, Dog Day. It's Thursday night's Arena. You can text us if you like. 51551. Our WhatsApp is 0870 32 32 32. Email is arena@rte.ie. And we are still on Instagram at @RTE_Arena. Tonight, because it's Thursday, as always, we start with Arena's film reviews. We've quite the mix for you tonight. In Pillion, Harry Melling plays wallflower parking attendant Colin, who falls for Alexander Skarsgård's dominant gay biker Ray in Pillion. Try saying that twice. A romantic comedy of sorts, but with a deep power exchange at its core. Daniel Craig is back as genius mystery solver Benoit Blanc in the latest iteration of Knives Out. This one is called Wake Up Dead Man. It has an unsurprisingly huge cast, including Josh O'Connor and two home favourites in Andrew Scott and Daryl McCormack. Andrew Scott appears again in Richard Linklater's Blue Moon, along with Ethan Hawke and Margaret Qualley. The film focuses on the final tragic days of the Broadway lyricist Lorenz Hart. And in Christie, Sydney Sweeney packs a punch in the true story of trailblazing female boxer Christie Martin. Ruth Barton and Donald Clark join me in studio. We'll begin with Pillion, a kinky romance set in suburban England, which Alexander Skarsgård has helpfully described as a dom-com. Donald, tell us about Colin and Ray.
Yeah, well, it's funny that when I read the synopsis of this before going to see it at Cannes, I thought we're going to see a grim, explicit, terrifying depiction of sexual depravity. Something like Kenneth Anger's Scorpio Rising. In the description is that we have two characters. You have the character played by Harry Melling, Colin, who is an introverted guy who lives an ordinary life with his ill mother and his nice father in Bromley, I think. You can hardly pick a more apt place to put a character of that nature, who falls in with a statuesque biker played by no less statuesque an actor than Alexander Skarsgård, and becomes his sexual submissive. So all this sort of sounds like, you know, kind of, you know, sexy and hot and also kind of like slightly terrifying, but it's in fact an incredibly gentle and rather funny film. And Harry Melling, more than anything else to me, seems to be channeling Norman Wisdom from the 1940s and 50s, that kind of little man who gets stuck in a situation that he can't quite handle. I think that dynamic is therefore actually sweet and funny before it's anything else. And praise should also go, I think, well, obviously praise should go to Skarsgård. He's a terrific actor and always owns any scene that he's in. But he gets at this wonderful kind of comic boredom of, like, you know, of what it is to be the best looking guy in the room when you really haven't got much else to offer. He lives in this bland house. He plays the piano blandly for recreation. He seems to be at the same point in that novel, My Struggle, every time he sits down to bed in bed to read it. And a man with no great personality, who you would think in any other environment would be in no position to dominate a man the way he dominates poor old Colin. But I think all those things add up to quite an interesting dynamic in a film that sounds as if it could have been more one-dimensional than it turns out to be.
Ruth, it's that contrast as well of Alexander Skarsgård playing the most Alexander Skarsgård character he's played in quite some time. And this middle England of, even at the very beginning, we first meet Harry Melling's character. He's singing in a barbershop quartet with his father at a local pub. It's a wonderful contrast.
It's a wonderful, and it's so very English, this film, because a lot of it's about, you know, as Donald says, Colin lives in the suburbs, in this, you know, nondescript suburb. And a lot of it's about inhibition and class. But it's also about that middle class, or kind of, you know, devote, like, decent working class folk who actually are fine with their son being gay. And one of the things about this opening pub scene where they're singing their Christmas songs in their, you know, Christmas Guernseys, is that Mum has actually fixed him up with a date in the pub. And so Colin meets this date, and clearly the date isn't the guy Colin was hoping for. But then his eyes, of course, light, as you say, on Ray, Alexander Skarsgård, who looks like, he kind of looks like a sort of cross between Clint Eastwood at his most introverted and something from outer space, because he clearly doesn't fit in the pub. And all he has to do is invite Ray to meet him the next night in the Primark car park. Romantic location. This is not.
On Christmas Day.
On Christmas Day. And so he has to go out, and Mum says, you know, would you like anything? And he borrows Dad's leather jacket. and off he goes. And then he discovers, as he says, you know, several times in the movie, that he has an aptitude for devotion.
Let's take something from the film. This is Alexander Skarsgård as impossibly handsome Ray. He shows up to the house to collect Harry Melling's Cullen for their date, and his parents, played by Douglas Hodge and Leslie Sharp, are a little bit flabbergasted.
Gosh, you're tall. Sorry, Peggy. Peggy, Peter. Nice to meet you.
Ray.
How do you do?
Time for a quick drink?
No, thank you. Not when I'm writing.
No, of course not. What was I thinking? Good lad, yeah. Well, something soft.
We better get going.
Yeah. You don't sound local, Ray. Where's home?
Chislehurst.
Chislehurst? Well, very nice.
I've never thought of Colin as a Chislehurst sort of person.
Nah, he'll survive. All right. Come on then, Colin.
All right. You just...
All right, hey.
Oh, Ray, sorry to fuss, but you do have a spare helmet, yes?
Yes.
Only he actually has to wear it.
Dad.
Because he's not getting on without one.
He is not getting on without one.
Great. Nice bike. Plain black. None of this neon crap like you see everywhere nowadays, don't you?
Colin.
Yep.
You sure you know what you're doing?
Yeah, don't worry, Dad.
I'm not worried. I rode a bike when I met Connie's mum. I sold it when the twins came along. Bought a very expensive pram. I don't suppose you two need to worry about that. Not yet, anyway.
I think there's Alan Bennett about it, isn't there?
Yes, isn't there?
That Alan Bennett thing about finding great comedy in ordinary English place names.
Yeah, and sort of non sequiturs as well.
I would never think of you as being a Chislehurst sort of person. What does that mean? I mean, do they in Bromley, do they find Chislehurst very sophisticated? Is that the dynamic
that seems
of that
to be the implication.
Part of South East England?
I'm conscious of the slight pun here, but I mean, all of the real heavy lifting in this is done by Harry Melling. It is really his film.
I think so, yeah. Partly for the reasons that I mentioned earlier on, that I think that Ray is supposed to be enormously handsome, sophisticated in a bland way, but frankly enormously dull. I think that is part of the gag, that in fact you have this guy who is either worshipping this character or is inhabiting the role of somebody who is worshipping this character. It's kind of a complicated double bluff there in terms of the relationship. But in fact, the character he's worshipping is enormously hollow inside. There's nothing really there, to quote Gertrude Stein in Oakland. The film does interrogate that relationship towards the end. It would be simple to say this is a lifestyle. We make no judgment on this lifestyle. It works out fine for both of them. But it doesn't quite work out fine for both of them, because in the end, basically, Colin gets a bit tired of it all and wants to have a day off in the week. But I mean, it's clear that you get a sense that that doesn't really work with how that game is played. But you do have a boring day off where they go to the cinema, the kind of boring day off you'd only get in Bromley, I suspect. But I think the ultimate deduction is that, you know, there are ways out of these relationships, and there are ways that you can sand down aspects of those relationships and make them a little more easy to live with on a week-by-week basis. So I think it is interrogating that in quite a practical way.
Okay, give me some stars on this.
Four.
Ruth?
Four.
Four from both of you. We will have Alexander Skarsgård, an interview with him on the show tomorrow night. Our next movie, Ethan Hawke, stars as celebrated lyricist Lorenz Hart, who with fellow composer Richard Rodgers created classics like The Lady is a Tramp and My Funny Valentine. Blue Moon, another one of their smash hits, is the title of a new biopic set over the course of one turbulent night in March 1943. And it was filmed in Ireland as well. Ruth, where are we when we join Blue Moon?
Well, we're at the end of poor Lawrence's life. So this is, people may be more sort of familiar with Rodgers and Hammerstein, but before Rodgers and Hammerstein, it was Rodgers and Hart. And Hart was this very famous, very edgy, alcoholic, closeted gay man who wrote some of the great lyrics from musical theatre. And he wrote My Funny Valentine, he wrote The Lady is a Tramp, he wrote Manhattan. But the earworm of the title is Blue Moon, and everybody, you know, as soon as you play it, everybody recognises it. And it's also the thing, it's haunted him for the rest of his life because he's kind of too edgy to have written Blue Moon, but he wrote it and it was a huge success. So we start with him, he falls down in a gutter and we know he's going to die. And then we flash back to a night in, it's 1943, it's Manhattan, it's wartime. And he's just walking out in disgust of the opening night of Oklahoma, exclamation point, as he always describes it. In disgust because this is bland Americana and they're all singing, you know, whatever, the grass is as high as an elephant's eye and whirling their caps in the air, and he's disgusted and he goes to Saudi's.
This is another collaboration between Richard Linklater and Ethan Hawke, Donald, isn't it? It's not the first.
Going back a long way, Boyhood, and then the Before films, obviously before that, and it's a happy combination. Who would not want to see interest in a film about Lawrence Hart by a master of talkie cinema, and he showed that in the Before trilogy, as I say, somebody who can actually make music out of conversation in a way that few directors can. And there is a lot to enjoy here. It's rich with allusions to a glorious period, I think, in US entertainment, when Rodgers and Hammerstein were embarking on Oklahoma and America was about to rule the world culturally in a way it hadn't quite between the wars, but definitely did after 1945. Hawke is, I think, undeniably great. I mean, he's here embodying one of the great American WASPs. And when I say WASPs, I don't mean white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. I mean one of the great WASPish characters in the school of Gore Vidal. I mean, they get at a certain kind of caricature of the witty gay man there, which may be a little bit simplified in this instance, but I think it's nonetheless very entertaining. And it has complicated and, I think, sincere fun with his sexuality. And the world thinks him gay, but he is in this current relationship with Elizabeth Weiland, played by Margaret Qualley. I do have some issues with it, though. The film is based on a series of letters between those two characters I just mentioned, and you can tell. It feels very much, I mean, there's the old problem of, like, is this a play or is this a film, which I think is often an unfair thing to say, because if the dialogue is working for you, then it would work for you as well on film as it would in a cinema. But here I think it's almost like a monologue a lot of the time. It's like a 1 hour, 35-minute monologue interrupted with occasional comments from those circling about the central character. That, for me, is an issue. It settles down to a more proper duologue later on when he has a long conversation with Margaret Qualley. But that for me was a bit of an issue. Also, I had an issue. It's not like a small thing, no pun intended, but the attempts to represent his smallness, his lack of height, which is a significant thing in the story, I think ends up verging on the ludicrous. I mean, I was reminded of that Jennifer Saunders and Don French parody of The Lord of the Rings, where Don French was standing like 20 feet in the background whenever she was talking to Jennifer Saunders to give the impression that she was much smaller as a hobbit. A lot of that stuff going on. I'm sitting in huge chairs to give the impression he's smaller than he's walking through trenches, obviously, when he's looking up at characters, people like Andrew Scott, who I think would probably be a bit shorter than Ethan Hawke with the best will in the world. I found that I couldn't put that out of my mind watching the film. And I'm sorry if that's pedantic of me, but I couldn't quite put it out of my mind.
Ruth, it's filmed in Ireland. What do we know about that? And about, obviously, there are a lot of familiar Irish faces that show up in this as well.
Yeah, it was filmed in Ireland. It was Saudi's was recreated in Dublin. And it's really fun to see a lot of Irish actors in it. Simon Delaney actually plays Hammerstein, which he's great at. And, of course, Andrew Scott. But then Andrew Scott is a global actor anyway. Mm. But there are a lot of smaller Irish
actors.
Michael
J. Ford, I saw.
Michael J. Ford is in it. Yes. And there was, you know, actors getting a chance to... I mean, this may sound a bit patronising, but actors getting a chance to be on a big screen with great stars. And apparently, you know, word has it they had a lovely time here, and Ethan Hawke loves Dublin. And so, I mean, you don't know it's Dublin, right? If you weren't told, you wouldn't know. But it shows that these kind of runaway productions can really bring something with them as well.
Does it work for you?
I loved it. I mean, I completely get what Donald's saying about, you know, it is distracting. And Ethan Hawke has to kind of crane his neck slightly up and to the left to actually talk to Andrew Scott, or indeed to Margaret Qualley, who's maybe about 2 foot taller than him. But there was just something about it. I loved the feeling, the period feeling. It's had a kind of sincerity to it. And it was exploring ideas about sentimentality and American utopianism at its heart, because one of the things is that he and the barman, Hart and the barman, riff on Casablanca throughout the film. And his favourite line, Hart's favourite line from Casablanca is, "Nobody ever loved me that much," which of course is deeply sentimental. So as much as he's rubbishing sentimentality, he's also a sucker for it. And so are we in a certain way too.
Okay, let's go for stars on this.
I loved it. It's a 5 for me.
Donald? I would give it a 3. There was too many things holding back for me. I also did not at all care for the gag about Stephen Sondheim, who turns up as a child at one point, which I felt was really... I know he was mentored by Hammerstein, but that felt like a whack gag too far for me.
Okay, that's Blue Moon. Rian Johnson is a man with cozy crime solving on the mind. Again, he is back with his third Knives Out film. This one is called Wake Up Dead Man. Stars, as usual, a who's who of modern Hollywood, joining Danielle Craig, Josh O'Connor, Jeremy Renner, Kerry Washington, Andrew Scott again, and Daryl McCormack in this. Donald, this is the third iteration of the Knives Out, whatever you want to call it at this stage. Josh O'Connor is at the centre of this story, so set it up for us.
I'm not entirely sure about these films, which throw a little too much camp at a genre which for me works best with restraint. By that genre, I mean the cosy Agatha Christie mysteries that are done on a large scale in films like Murder on the Orient Express and Death in the Nile. I mean, they were all packed with stars, but there was a sense they were minding their manners. I thought Knives Out was overblown and Glass Onion was whatever you get when the overblown gets blown over it again. But this, I will say, having said that, having put my colours to the mast, this seemed to be the best of the three, I think, because it does at times operate on the scale of a BBC Two drama of the 1990s, and I don't mean that in a bad way. I think that is in many ways often the best way to experience the Agatha Christie aesthetic. The story in this case is... Josh O'Connor is a priest who is sent to a diocese after various difficulties, where he encounters the apparently insane Josh Brolin, who is the local priest. I don't think we can say too much about the plot. In fact, I know that Rian Johnson is incredibly sensitive about people giving any details away. So what we will say is that there is a locked door mystery about a third of the way in, one of those great John Dickinson Carr situations where someone is killed in a situation where no one can get in or could get out of the room in which he is killed. And the film, to a large extent, is an essay on that convention in mystery fiction. You get references to John Dixon Carr. At one point, someone sits down and outlines the only ways in which that murder can be committed in these films, and ultimately, of course, the game is picking which of these it turns out to be. All that's practice of my light, and I like the actors in it, all of whom get the notion they are playing mono-adjectival characters. They're here to do just one thing, essentially, that identifies their character, and I think all of them do that pretty well.
Ruth, does this work for you? Do they look like they're having fun?
They look like they're having fun, and they're having very expensive fun. Netflix.
More fun than us at times.
Yes, indeed. More fun than us at times. I mean, I'm with Donald on this one because I did like the first one because it came out of the blue and it was a surprise, and it was actually a kind of cheap, hokey one. And then they went, I thought, totally over the top with Glass Onion.
Yeah.
They tried to do a Bond on it and it was just silly. And I agree. I think this one's gone back to first principles. It does work as a kind of pastiche Agatha Christie. And I do know, I mean, I went to quite a busy cinema. People went in, they really wanted to love it. They came out satisfied. They'd loved it. So I think if you like the first ones, you're going to get it. For me, there was a real sag in the middle because it ends up being sort of a duo between the priest and Benoit Blanc.
Well, it's also a strange dynamic in terms of like who is the lead of this film.
Yes,
because
Josh
O'Connor is the lead of this film until Benoit Blanc arrives, and then he becomes the assistant. He becomes Higgins to Poirot. He becomes Watson to Sherlock Holmes.
And then they also have a local detective as well thrown in. They have this local female detective thrown in
up
as well.
So yes, that's right.
And so what happens is this huge cast of ancillary, quite famous characters has nothing to do at that point because they've introduced, they've got their character quirks, they're then put aside, and then they're reintroduced back at the end. So I thought it was quite long and a little bit of a sag in the middle, but I think for those people who love this series, it'll be another winner.
Okay, let's hear a moment from it. We're going to take the second of our clips that we have here when Daniel Craig as Benoit Blanc arrives on the scene and he meets Josh O'Connor's father, Judd, and tells him that he solves murders.
Who are you?
I probably should have led with this. My name is Benoit Blanc. I'm a detective. I've taken an interest in the murder of Jefferson Wicks.
You're a detective, so you're with the police?
No. I work in a private capacity.
Everyone thinks I did it. I didn't do it. But in my heart, maybe I didn't. And the way it happened was some kind of miracle. And I don't know. I'm lost. I don't know.
Would you allow me to help you?
What?
Your lips are cracked with dehydration. You haven't slept all night. You spent it out of doors by the stadium, pant legs on your knees in prayer. What I see is not a guilty man in torment, but an innocent man tormented by guilt. Let me help you.
How?
This was dressed as a miracle. It's just a murder, and I solve murders.
Donald, a lot of the believability of this in terms of whether or not you can stick with this film, quite a lot of that is based on Daniel Craig's Benoit Blanc, his accent in particular, and whether or not you can get past
thing about that. In this, you can tell me if I'm misremembering this, but in the second film, there was an implication that he was putting all that on as way to unnerve the various suspects he's talking about, to have them underestimate him. In a direct comparison, obviously, with Columbo in the great series of the 1970s, where Peter Falk's character obviously pretended to be dumber than he was as he wandered in, but when in fact he was the cleverest person in any room that he was in. There was that suggestion was there in the second film. That's gone. Now, again, he just seems to be this person. He seems to be this absurd Cajun character with an accent that defies all belief.
And a weird tweed suit and slightly longer hair than in the last one. Hair's got a bit longer.
So I was puzzled by that. I mean, are we now supposed to believe this is a real person?
Are we supposed to believe that any of this could have happened? I mean, anyway, really, this is not a documentary.
So. No, well, that's true. That is certainly true.
But
there's a spectrum, isn't there, Ruth? Like, you've got to place somewhere on the spectrum the utter absurdity and social and Mike Lee's social realism. Yeah, I'm not quite sure where it is on that spectrum.
Because it's also poking at, you know, white guys have gone crazy on power. So and I think that, you know, that Johnson is, he was trying to push us to believe, this is a satire on the real America. Well, you'd have to be, you know, you'd have to be willing it.
Pretty broad. It could be a satire on any power dynamic ever in the history of the world. Certainly, it's not precise enough to justify that description he's putting upon it. But I think we should clarify what this is doing as well in terms of like the audience that it's for. The first one, interestingly, they released in cinemas and it did really well. And then they put it straight onto Netflix and then it's a goner. Once it's on Netflix, it's a goner. This is opening for 2 weeks, as Netflix films tend to do when they get any kind of release. But this is Netflix's version of the old big Christmas movie. You know, the notion you sat down and you watched The Great Escape or you watched the James Bond film, whatever it was. This is their version of that. I mean, it's coming out, it's being released this week theatrically. It's out 2 weeks on Netflix. And this is the thing they're expecting people to sit around at Christmas time when they're full of turkey and full of port wine.
And want
to either enjoy it or doze in front of it. And they're probably right. Exactly.
I think it will do very well. You don't want to be challenged at Christmas once you've had
it. Very well on Netflix. The economics of theatrical exhibition for these films, it's beyond
publicity.
Me.
It gets
beyond me. But I think it will do extremely well on Netflix.
I think so too, yeah. It's very harmless.
Let me get some very harmless. That's all.
Oh, damned with faint praise.
Let me get some stars, Ruth.
Well, I took myself out of my seat and I put myself in somebody else's seat as a viewer and I gave it 4. Personally, you know, for me, it's more like a 3, really.
Donald?
I'm sticking with 3. It's incredibly 3-starry for me. One of the most 3-starry films of the year.
Now on to our final film this week. Inside the boxing ring, Christy Martin would go on to become one of the most successful female contenders in American sports history. Outside, she faced a multitude of private battles. Sydney Sweeney plays the iconic boxer in the newly released Christy. Ruth, remind us who Christy Martin was.
Well, I didn't know. I'd never heard of her before the movie, and you know, I actually didn't bother looking up after the movie because I wasn't that interested. But she was an iconic boxer of her day. It's the film starts in 1989, so it's really, you know, during the 1990s. And she was also really the woman in real life who made female boxing a box office draw for pay-per-view. This is when pay-per-view is rising as well. So she became this huge star of the female boxing circuit. And as a consequence, many other women began to get paid properly and all these things, because she doesn't get any of this at the beginning. But she's called Martin. Her surname is Martin because she marries her boxing manager, and who's Jim Martin. And then the story, and it's not giving anything away because this has been widely discussed, then becomes a story about the fact that she is a lesbian, but this is really disapproved of in West Virginia, where she comes from. And so she marries him to sort of be straight, it's like a beard kind of relationship. But he's into this as a marriage, but he's into it as an abusive, coercive, control relationship. So the film sort of hovers between being about two things. One is about her career in the boxing ring until it ends horribly. And then the other part of it, which kind of picks up, then is about this story of coercive control.
Okay, I want to take a moment from the film. This is where Christy meets Don King, played by Chad L. Coleman.
And you must be the lady I've been hearing so much about. Christy, how old are you?
I'm 24, sir.
You're pretty. And you really a fighter?
Yes, sir. It's an honor to meet you, Mr. King.
Well, tell me about yourself. Jesse here says that you fight in all pink. That's good. I like pink.
Well, I'm from West Virginia.
What's that got to do with pink?
Nothing, sir. I'm just telling you about myself.
Yeah, pink was my idea.
West Virginia. Coal miner country.
Yes, sir. My daddy and my brother worked the mines.
So what in the hell are you fighting, Christy? What's a pretty girl like you doing getting punched in the face for a living?
I'm good at it, sir.
Donald, Sidney Sweeney has undergone a fairly decent transformation for this, but is she any good in the film?
Yeah. I mean, I think that she's going through a strange period in her career currently. In that she arrived, well, she'd been around for a few years, but she really arrived about a year and a bit ago with films like Reality and Immaculate, and was suddenly there as an old school movie star, maybe the kind of person who could open movies. And sadly, with Christy, she's demonstrated that is not one of her gifts. It opened extremely poorly and then headed off and then collapsed even further the second week. And as a result, a large portion of America seems to have got down on her. I mean, I really decided that the whole thing was overblown and that she's some kind of menace, which has all got caught up with vaguely defined political issues, and it's been decided that she's a representative of MAGA America. And I mean, that's the nature of current society, the sort of mad online discourse goes on. But one thing I would say is that I don't think anyone can say she's a bad actor. She's an extremely good actor. She was excellent in Reality. She was great in Immaculate. And I think she's very good here. All that said, it's a very conventional straight down the line boxing movie, which plays all the familiar tunes. And sadly, because this relates to her real life, it's also kind of quite a conventional story in terms of how it's told, story of an abusive relationship. We've seen this many times before in cinema, representing a terrible truth that exists, but nonetheless, that doesn't make it any less familiar in terms of how it's played out. But I do think she's extremely good in it. I think the boxing sequences are great. They battle that nice balance between how this actually looks in the ring and the kind of more accelerated version that you get in Rocky and even actually in Raging Bull. I mean, the fights in Raging Bull, brilliant as they are, look nothing like real fights. It's somewhere between Reality and that, and I kind of felt every blow that she dispatches throughout the film.
Okay, I'm going to get stars from both of you, but before I get yours, Ruth, briefly, what did you think?
I wasn't as taken by it. And I don't think the film bombed because of Sydney Sweeney or the jeans she wears. I think it's because, one, the story's not particularly familiar, so people aren't going to see it because they remember the real person. And I don't think her fan base is into girl boxing movies. And I also don't think it's a very good movie. So I don't think it's for any of the... I mean, the stuff around it is terrible and, you know... But she'll rise above it. She'll move on.
So I hope so, because she's a good actor. And, and we need movie stars.
She's got plenty of potential. It's a two for me.
It's a two from you, Donald.
I'm being Derek Smalls tonight, lukewarm water. So again, it's another three from me.
And thanks to Ruth Barton and Donald Clark. Pillion, Blue Moon, Christy and Wake Up Dead Man and Knives Out Mystery all open this weekend in cinemas, and Wake Up Dead Man will be on Netflix on December 12th. Just to mention as well, an interesting Irish documentary film called Born That Way has just had its run at the IFI in Dublin. Extended Born That Way tells the story of Kilkenny man Patrick Lydon and his trailblazing Camp Hill movement. The film will be at ARC Cinemas in Cork and Ennis in early December, along with one-off screenings at various arts centres around the country. You can see Born That Way film .com for details. A and you're listening to Thursday Night's Arena. Greatest Baselines is a three-part docuseries which lands on Sky Arts and Now tomorrow and celebrates the best bass players and greatest bassline riffs. Each of the three programmes is hosted by a different bass player who breaks down those lines that defined their careers and the riffs that inspired them. They're Peter Hook of Joy Division and New Order, Nate Mendel from Foo Fighters, and Melissa Ofdermar from Hole and Smashing Pumpkins. There's also a fairly stellar list of guests that include Glenn Matlock and Alex James, Chris Novoselic, Adam Clayton, Gaylan Dorsey, and the recently deceased Stone Roses bassist Manny. Katja Reardon, herself a legendary bass player with the Pogues, has watched the series, and I'm delighted she joins me in studio to tell us all about it. What are you laughing at? Katja, first of all, before I get into any of this, maybe tell me what drew you to the bass as an instrument in the first place.
It's only got four strings, which is two less to have to think about. So that's immediately attractive. It's bigger, it's thicker, and the strings are thicker, and I've got wee stumpy fingers. And electric bass, you put it on, you plug it in, and it is, Adam Clayton says this in the program, and it's the one thing we all say as bass players, it's such a physical thing. It's low-rooted vibration, and it's thrilling.
Before we get into any of this, I'm going to play a little of your bass playing. You joined the Pogues, you played on Red Roses for Me and Rum Sodomy and The Lash. So let's have a listen to you on one of the tracks that you played on. This is A Pair of Brown Eyes.
One summer evening, drunk to hell, I sat there nearly lifeless. An old man in the corner sang, where the water lilies grow. And on the jukebox, Johnny sang about a thing called love. And it's how are you, kid, and what's your name, and how did you bloody know? In blood and death, neath a screaming sky, I lay down on the ground, and the arms and legs of other men were scattered all around. Some cursed, some prayed, some prayed, then cursed, then prayed, then bled some more. And the only thing that I could see was a pair of brown eyes that was looking at me.
That's the Pogues, Pair of Brown Eyes, and you just reminded us that is it 2 years?
It'll be 2 years on Saturday, and obviously sending out huge love to Shane's family and his fans as well, everywhere I go. I've just come back from New York. There's not a day people aren't just coming up and talking about Shane. And of course, the story of the week was Bob Dylan singing Rainy Night in Soho for him in Dublin the other night. So love to all the Pogues family.
Yeah, and from all of us here at Arena as well. Okay, this series, Greatest Baselines, they're 3-hour-long programmes, each of them hosted by a different bass player. What do they do with that within those 3 hours? What's the format?
They waste it.
Tell me what you really think.
It's almost contradictory. It's each episode, it's 45 minutes of footage, and it's absolutely stuffed with the top of the top. You named some of them. And they're just the best, and it's so great. But you get them for like a sentence at a time. It hops around, it cuts up, and it's so not what bass players are. There's actually a whole section where each of the interviewees is asked, what type of person is a bass player? And we all say the same thing. We're all very calm, we're very organised. Mm. Everyone who's seen Spinal Tap is shouting lukewarm water.
<'cause> that's the second time it's been referenced here tonight.
That's the iconic phrase. Between the fire and the ice, the bass player is the lukewarm water. So we're very calm people, and you could happily listen to any person that's in these programmes talk for half an hour about what they do. And instead you get his 10 seconds of Adam Clayton, his 10 seconds of Gail Ann Dorsey, his 10 seconds of Manny. And I was yelling at the screen so many times, hold it, hold it, hold it, don't cut again. But that's how it's done.
You're looking for the 12-part box set version of this.
I really, every single time they cut to Peter Hook, he's holding another beautiful bass and they never ask him to talk about the bass he is holding.
Okay. It's, okay,
my blood pressure's going up thinking about it.
I want to give people an idea of the sort of songs that are heard the programme. So we do have a little montage of some of the bass lines that are talked about. If you haven't been nodding your head and tapping your foot at home, you may need to seek medical attention. Peter Hook hosts the first episode. He played bass originally with Joy Division and then with New Order. And he looks back to the early days of Joy Division and how they formed and how they got together. It's really interesting.
It's a classic story. There's so many bands that have the same story. The Sex Pistols did a tour. They booked a tour. There's an important distinction. They booked a tour. Then they went on a Tea Time TV show and swore, and then most of the gigs were immediately cancelled, but they did get to the Free Trade Hall in Manchester. And the story goes that there was maybe 50 people at most that went, but like the Velvet Underground's album, everyone that was there went home and formed a band. And Peter Hook says him and his mate that he calls Barney, who we call Bernard Sumner, had exactly the same reaction. They said, we got to start a band. And then they met their mate Ian Curtis, who was in another band, and his band broke up. So Ian Curtis joined Barney and Peter Hook. It's a heartwarming tale that ends in absolute tragedy, of course. But Hook describes this beautiful thing. It's always been a canonical line for bass players that Peter Hook is so instantly identifiable because the gear was not great back then. And Barney's, I call him Barney now, his guitar was so loud that Peter Hook had to play up the neck. He had to play high. Obviously, we think the sound of the bass is boom. And Peter Hook had to go just to cut through the sound. And aren't we glad he did?
There's so many people in the documentary who talk about that influencing them and the way they played their bass.
Yeah, Digo. I've got to say, Adam Clayton and Digo were there. Ireland is very well represented here. And when they cut to Digo from Fontaine's DC talking about it, it's I gotta say, I feel like a proud auntie whenever I see those lads. They're so cool. And the weird thing is, they like all the bands we like. It's a completely different generation, but their taste is so good.
I'm going to, because I feel it only fair to play the beginning of Joy Division's Love Will Tear Us Apart. Yeah. Here we go.
We'll be right back.
Joy Division, Lovell Tears Apart. So the second episode is Melissa of Damar. She hosts the second one. She played with Hole, and then later on she goes on to play with the Smashing Pumpkins. Did you know her work? Were you familiar with it?
I didn't. I got to say, I was in the 90s. I was a bit snobby about Hole, grunge, and I just didn't pay any attention to any of that. She was a name I knew. I knew that there were these great women musicians who were in bands I didn't like. There was Melissa and there was Darcy and, of course, the Pixies. I did like Kim Deal. So watching the Melissa Aftermath episode was really interesting to me. I really liked her emphasis on, I appreciated hearing that she puts an emphasis on being a woman who plays bass, which never had any meaning to me. I always thought I was a boy, so I was treated as a boy. But she made some great comments about that she really thunk about it. Like, I'm a woman and I'm playing bass and I'm in these bands. What does that mean? And she said she felt the easiest way to be at the center of a song was to be the bass. And so that's what she did. And then she made it a part of her life to encourage other women musicians, which is so admirable, but just not my particular thing.
There's an interesting comment in that one. Adam Clayton from U2 says that women bass players brought a female energy to bands. What did you make of that?
I love Adam Clayton. God bless him. He's so cool. And, you know, he's hearing something that is lost on me, because I grunt and I sweat and I jump around and I'm bigger than most of the lads I play with as well. You know, listener, I'm 6 foot of aggression and my nickname is Rocky. So I never felt feminine at all on stage, but I really loved hearing Adam's point of view on that. And I just liked the thought that there were women musicians who were thinking, I am a woman and I am a musician, because that is an important energy to have.
I want to bring something else in that's mentioned in the documentary and that's played as well. This is The Temptations' Papa Was a Rolling Stone. Conscious, because that's one of my favourite songs, that goes on for about another 3 minutes before it manages to make it into the vocal.
It's verse. It's three notes. Geezer Butler talking about that is so beautiful.
He does, he says that. Yeah. In the third episode, then, you've got Nate Mendel and he meets Chris Novoselic from Nirvana as well at one point as well. But he talks about the Scottish bassist with Cream, Jack Bruce, and his playing on Sunshine of Your Love.
I was so happy that they did that. Jack Bruce, he was in a band, and the other two lads in the band were Eric Clapton and Ginger Baker. And that's a situation where you are always going to be the overlooked one, which is kind of criminal, because Jack Bruce is one of the all-time great songwriters, performers. And I had the great pleasure of sitting next to Jack Bruce at the Ivor Novello Awards a few years ago. And I don't know if they still do this, but the Ivor Novello Awards, everyone's dressed up. They're sitting at tables like a fancy award show. And it's in London and they play, ladies and gentlemen, please stand for the national anthem. And they play God Save the Queen. So I fold my arms, glue my arse to the chair and say, I'm not standing up. Everyone stands around. It's a bit awkward. And Jack Bruce sitting next to me goes, well, if she's not standing up, I'm not standing up. And we just sat there and just vibed in our Celtic badness and nobody said a thing.
OK, you've watched all three episodes of this. Is it the sort of thing you'd recommend that people take a look at?
watch it, of course. Watch it, fall in love with all the great bass players. Here's stuff you didn't know. If you're a Hooky fan, you will adore it. My favourite episode that I learnt the most from was from Nate Mendel. I do not like Foo Fighters. I actively turn off Foo Fighters when they come on. But he's the most what I wanted from the programme. He's the most into what is a bass line, the physics, the construction. He's a big nerd like me. And so just watch all of them, please, and enjoy it.
Yeah, and definitely worth it for that conversation that he has with Chris Novoselic from Nirvana. What we're going to do is we'll finish off with a little bit of Nirvana.
Nice.
And the series itself is well worth a look. It is on Sky Arts and now from tomorrow. It's called Greatest Basslines. And Katja Reardon, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Emily LaBarge is a Canadian art and literary critic based in London. Her work has appeared in Granta, London Review of Books, and the Paris Review. Her first book, Dog Days, is an experimental memoir about narrative, trauma, art, writing, and cinema. At its core is an attack her family went through in 2009. They were spending Christmas on an island in the Caribbean when six armed men broke into their holiday home and held them hostage for hours. Threaded through this account are ideas on everything from Virginia Woolf to films such as Mulholland Drive and It's a Wonderful Life. Dog Days has a Dublin launch tomorrow evening at Books Upstairs with Emily LaBarge and Mark O'Connell. I'm delighted Emily is on the line now. Welcome to Arena.
Thank you very much.
Dog Days, it's not a straightforward narrative in any real sense. Maybe just to anchor us a little, tell us about what happened to you, what you refer to in the book as the good story, which starts as you and your family are on a holiday.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of basically what you just summed up in your little wonderful intro there. Effectively, we were on holiday in the Caribbean and had this practice of sort of not celebrating Christmas and not exchanging gifts and instead going away together. And unfortunately, this befell us on that particular occasion that we were held hostage in what I suppose people would call a home invasion, but might also be called a sort of kidnapping or a hostage taking. Fortunately, no one was badly hurt, but the experience itself sort of resonated with me for many years afterwards, as I think is imaginable.
It is. Even at the very beginning of the book, you talk about how Mrs. Doubtfire is playing on the screen, and as a small child, you're there having to just listen to the film while all this is going on around you.
Oh, I wasn't a small child, though. I was 25. but it was one of my favorite films when I was a child. So it had this kind of eerie effect of watching this kind of, you know, lighthearted family comedy with Robin Williams that people know. He dresses up as a Scottish nanny so he can spend time with his children after divorcing his wife. And of course, it's quite funny, but immediately turned not so much, but turned into this kind of surreal, uncanny soundtrack to what was otherwise this sort of protracted, terrifying experience.
Yeah, the phrase the good story, it's that thing that publishers, if you were to be cynical about it, would suggest you've got this ready-made trauma story, which is quite appetizing in the industry. But you've subverted that with Dog Days, haven't you?
Yes, that was one of the main aims. I mean, I think that there are people who are working in nonfiction who I looked to, people like Anne Boyer or Carmen Maria Machado, or even someone like Mark O'Connell, who write books in an unconventional narrative fashion because they're interested in how particular kinds of stories might break the mold that we expect of a kind of beginning, middle, end. The idea that maybe a story about trauma necessarily has a catharsis or some kind of answer or solution, and use narrative form to tell a story in a different way, but also reflect back to us as readers how we might think of the world differently, because that's sort of the power of stories, I think. Yeah.
The story kind of percolates from different angles and from different perspectives, from seeing what happened to you in a kind of dissociated third person to a list of losses and then an abstract idea of language and narrative. How did that idea emerge?
I think it stemmed from this desire to remake the narrative. And of course, we understand personal narrative potentially to be mostly the subjective voice, to follow a series of events and internal ruminations. I found that after relaying what I remembered of what we might call the good story, which is kind of in the book, the story of what happened, but also the expectation of how you begin to tell the story to other people, be it kind of, you know, in a dismissive way or for official purposes, but then starts to morph into something else that I didn't have necessarily kind of the words to tell in what I thought was a straightforward manner. So there were kind of two forked impetus in that I had to rethink what could be on the page because I didn't remember things necessarily, or what I wanted to get at was the experience rather than the story itself. But it was also part of the project of thinking, you know, what's available to me as a writer in terms of the craft to remake a story through different angles that might give us more than, you know, what I think is a hallmark of trauma memoirs, which is the kind of singular, individual, exceptional narrative. And that can be very interesting and totally compelling, but it just wasn't what I was interested in doing because it felt like a bit of a lie, I suppose, or kind of a tidy version of what wasn't available to me when I thought about the experience itself.
Yeah, because memory is something you touch on a lot in Dog Days. There's a contradiction, three men. There are these small intentional deviations that you have in different retellings. And then you explicitly explore memory and identity because everybody believes their own memory in situations like that is absolute and correct. But of course it isn't.
Yeah, I mean, I sat down to write sort of trying to transcribe what I remembered in a very honest way when I started working on this book, because I wasn't sure what shape it would take. I wasn't sure how much narrative there would be. And I basically put down what I could remember, and it was full of holes. And I think we traditionally read memoirs or nonfiction or essays where the job of the writer in part is to sort of, you know, furnish those holes with details that make things hold together. And that's like a literary way of working. It's kind of one of the conceits we think, oh, well, this person probably didn't remember what happened to them when they're four. But for the sake of the form in the book, this is what I'm reading and this is what I'm invested in. And I didn't want to do that. And I was left with all of these gaps where I sort of thought, you know, this is super precise, and then this next moment is simply absent. And of course, I think this is the way memory works for a lot of people in general, right? We don't all have a kind of perfect recall. But traumatic memory in itself, which I write about quite a bit towards the end of the book, is kind of unique in that it sort of burns certain things in your brain while others disappear. And you never know if you just wouldn't remember them anyway, or if they're, you know, sort of repressed because they're frightening, or if memory is indexical, so you need something to make you recall it. So I was really interested in what that would look like on the page.
You're a cultural critic. You're somebody who's immersed in books and films and art as a way of life. Who are the writers and artists that you look to in the aftermath?
Joan Didion was a big one for me, even though my writing is, I think, very, very different from hers. But her particular... Yeah, I mean, I wish it weren't. Imagine. She's someone I've admired for a long time, in a way, because her prose is so sort of burned and bare and simple. And she delivers these images and assessments of great magnitude in a seemingly simple way. That's true of her essays and her more political journalism. But her later books, A Year of Magical Thinking and Blue Night, are about the death of her child and her husband, I think were very interesting to me in terms of retrospective projects, even though obviously she was writing from a kind of like elderly vantage point and about family members, but her project of memory and narrative and its sort of unwillingness to be sentimental, I think was very, very interesting to me, as was The Red Parts by Maggie Nelson, which is a book that she wrote about her aunt having been murdered, her mother's sister, and the trial being resurfacing again many, many, many years later with new DNA evidence. And she sort of writes through this in a kind of forensic way, but that's also essaying and essayistic. And to me, those were two models of people using voice and narrative in a compelling and unusual way to work through difficult material.
Unfortunately, we have run out of time here anyway, but Emily LaBarge, thank you so much for joining us on Arena tonight.
Thank you so much for having me.
Dog Days by Emily LaBarge is out now with Peninsula Press. Emily is launching it at Books Upstairs in Dublin tomorrow evening with Mark O'Connell. And that is it for tonight's Arena. Sheila O'Callaghan produced. Leah Murphy was our researcher. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. And Cara O'Hare was on sound. I'm Rick O'Shea. We're back tomorrow night from 7 when we'll be talking to Alexander Skarsgård and we'll take a look at the week's new TV and new music. John Creedon is next.